This is Keeping the Faith on the Mormon Faircast. The Keeping the Faith series explores ways in which our faith can be challenged and ways in which we can overcome those challenges.
That, like I said, I got really confused, and this is when I started up at Utah State. So I was confused, and I thought, I'm not going to have time to sort through all this right now anyway. I have to really devote myself this first semester, make sure I've got my, you know, self well established in school. So the first semester, I just completely kept my nose to the grindstone, and I got a 4.0, so it worked. Second semester, I started to come out of my cave a little, you know, and do more socially and try to figure out religious things more again. I started attending campus Christian events. There was a campus Christian organization. And I started visiting with the local Baha'is. It was a little local Baha'i community, you know. And I still, I became more involved with the Baha'is, actually, than I did with the campus Christian group, while still, you know, retaining my belief in Christ as the Son of God. Baha'is believe that Christ is what they call a manifestation of God. But by that, they don't mean the same thing that we mean by the Son of God. They don't believe that he was unique and that he was actually divine. He's sort of in between human and divine. So, you know, I continued to be Christian, but I was remembering the wonderful things that had drawn me to the Baha'i faith. In the process, I started believing actually more and more of what I had believed as a Latter-day Saint, because, as I mentioned, you know, the Baha'is, they believe in eternal marriage and, you know, some other, they believe in what they call progressive revelation, you know, across dispensations and so on. So I didn't realize it at the time. I didn't recognize that I was coming closer and closer to my Mormonism. In this process, though, I had sometimes struggled on the whole with Mormonism. I felt on the whole like, you know, there's no way that I can go back. There's no way that my work can fit into the Latter-day Saint community. There's no way that I can fit with the things that I believe and the things I feel like I can't believe. Once in a while, I would kind of take that off the shelf and I would think through it again and think, is there some way that I can make all this fit together, you know? And Maxine Hanks was my next-door neighbor in the Avenues just before I went up to Utah State. And she and I used to talk a lot, and for people who don't know who Maxine is, she was one of what are called the September Six. She was excommunicated in 1993 for her book that she edited called Women and Authority. It's a work of collected together the feminist writings of different Mormon scholars. So Maxine had been out of the church for a long time, but she had made peace in her mind with Joseph Smith in a way that I had not. And we used to talk, and, you know, I would lay things out and say, here are the problems, and I don't know how to fit these things together, you know, and that was useful for me, but I never never felt like I could really make things fit. So I was up at Utah State, my second semester there.
Just back up a little bit. Yeah. So Maxine Hanks was helping you to begin reconciling your problems with Joseph Smith.
Yes, while she was outside the church because she'd been excommunicated years earlier.
Right, and for those that don't know, she later came back to the church.
Yes. I'll mention her again when I talk about my rebaptism.
Okay, and so then you move up to Utah State and you're kind of, you know, going to the Christian groups and the Baha'i groups.
Sort of a Baha'i Christian.
A Baha'i Christian with this yearning toward Mormonism, but that you still can't quite answer all
right,
these
so
questions.
I just couldn't see overall kind of how to make things fit. There were some things that I could make fit, but then I would always get to some point where it would be like I was building a house of cards, you know, and I'd finally get to a certain point and the whole thing would collapse, you know. What happened, a few big things happened that semester. I was working with Dr. Barlow, taking a class from him.
He's the head of the religious studies program at USU.
He's not the head, but he's part of it. There's someone else who's the actual like chair of that.
Okay.
But, he's the Mormon studies chair.
Oh, I see. All right.
And an excellent scholar. One of the few people that I know whom I would describe as wise. Just very reflective. Has a lot of perspective. The class I was taking from him was on Joseph Smith biography and autobiography. I started really learning from him more of the perspective of religious studies, which I've been more focused on history for the most part than the broader discipline of religious studies. And right now I can't explain fully why, but it seems to me that it played a role in my returning to faith, but I haven't been able to define fully what that role was. I also, during that semester, I realized that I tend to overthink things. Like, I realized that thing that I was saying about to a man with a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. I realized that I tend to over-apply my analytical tools, and that I've tended to do that with emotions and things like that. Not that I've been... I mean, I haven't gone to the extreme with that, but I've tried to over-apply those tools. That made me start to wonder, maybe... how has this maybe been affecting my spiritual life? You know, I've been doing it there too. I've been trying to solve religious questions using the same tools that I used to analyze history. And it hasn't really seemed to work that well, you know. Question emerged for me. What if, this is when I started realizing that different domains of seeking truth have different toolboxes, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that maybe there was a toolbox that was appropriate to seeking religious and spiritual truth. And I didn't know fully what that toolbox would entail, but I thought certainly religious experience, you know, spiritual experience, revelation, and judging things by their fruits. That seemed to be something that I had encountered in various religious traditions as a way of finding spiritual truth. During that same semester, I was doing a paper on the first vision and some work on the lost 116 pages and what we can know about what was in them. And in the process of doing those projects, I learned things, I realized things that right at the end of the semester, I remember in the final days of the semester just being completely blown away by what I was finding, because I had assumed this common scholarly model where Joseph Smith, early on, he's much like the surrounding Protestants, and it's only much later in his life that he becomes more distinctive or weird, you know?
It's the kind of the Kirtland versus the Nauvoo model.
Yeah.
You know, that Joseph Smith started out as sort of a mainline Christian, but then by the time he got to Nauvoo, he starts developing, you know, temple theology and polygamy and, you know, all of these other ideas, and that, you know, there's this kind of, you know, clean break we can find. And so we're not finding any of those ideas in the Book of Mormon that are later
right.
coming out of Nauvoo.
Right. So in Joseph Smith's 1820s religious experiences and in the Book of Mormon, which he translates in 28 and 29, we don't have, my thinking was, well, we have stuff that sounds like Protestant doctrine, revivalistic, Joseph Smith's first vision has been compared to a revivalistic conversion experience.
Yeah, born again experience.
Yeah. I think even Richard Bushman, who is fantastic, by the way, I think it was him who said in his Joseph Smith biography, Rough Stone Rolling, that if Joseph Smith had stopped at the first vision, he would have fit well within the larger context of surrounding Christianity. There's nothing really distinctive. That what was distinctive was Book of Mormon with its claim to be new scripture. And Terrell Givens, who I know you've recently interviewed and who's also fantastic, I know he's argued that the Book of Mormon, the doctrine in the Book of Mormon really is not part of what makes Mormonism distinctive, that that's really more like traditional Christianity, and that's really starting with the Book of Moses that you have distinctive Mormon doctrine. These were things that I assumed, and I assumed the broader sort of model where I assumed that the endowment had arisen from Joseph Smith's 1842 initiation as a Freemason. After all, he gives the endowment like 7 weeks later or something for the first time. So what I found, though, in both in the extant Book of Mormon text and in what I could learn about the Lost Pages and in some of what I learned about Joseph Smith's early 1820s visions, was that none of that is true. Let's take the story of the brother of Jared, being given the interpreters on Mount Shelem. So the Lord, he's speaking with the Lord through the veil. That's the terminology that it uses. And the Lord puts his hand out of the veil to touch the stone. And then that initiates a series of questions that the Lord asks the brother of Jared to test his faith and knowledge. When his faith and knowledge have been proven, then he's admitted into the Lord's presence through the veil. And he's given higher knowledge that can't be just generally shared, so he seals it up in the sealed portion of the plates. He's also, the stones of the interpreters and the 16 small stones that he makes, they're these white stones. Well, in Nauvoo, Joseph Smith teaches that a new name will be given to everyone who enters the celestial kingdom, and with it will be associated a white stone. Yeah, so you have all this temple content in the Book of Mormon, in the Book of Ether. Well, that's 1829 that Joseph Smith translates the Book of Ether. So what happens to this idea that Joseph Smith doesn't know anything about the endowment and that distinctive Mormonism isn't there until later? Right. My idea has to disappear.
Well, and you probably came across Jack Welch's sermon at the temple,
right,
and Sermon on the Mount, and the ideas that King Benjamin's speech is a temple sermon, and so there are all of these other types analysis that's maybe fairly recent and emerging, that there is a lot of temple theology in the Book of Mormon.
Right. And it didn't fully strike me until this point, when I realized what I did about the brother of Jared's experience on the mountain. By the way, Joseph Smith said that for people who don't have the means, mountains can serve as temples. For those of us who do have the means, God requires us to build a temple. But he says that Moses, for instance, got his endowment up on the mountain. And so, brother of Jared is essentially getting an endowment on the top of this mountain, and it's right there. Something very similar is in an interview that someone did with Joseph Smith Sr., in 1830, that is part of what I've been analyzing for my Lost 116 Pages work. In this interview with Fayette Latham, Joseph Sr. narrates how the Nephites acquired those Jaredite interpreters that Brother Jared had been given on the mountain. And the narrative that he gives, it's being reported by someone who's never LDS. The narrative that he gives, it's, again, so strikingly, has such striking temple connections, you know. Just a bit of it. He says that the person who finds the interpreters, the guy doesn't remember the name. I believe it's Mosiah. I will argue in the book that it's King Mosiah I, whose story was in the lost 116 pages. He finds this object, and they have a tabernacle. They're apparently on a kind of exodus. He takes the object into the tabernacle, and as soon as he gets in there, the Lord asks, apparently from the other side of the veil in the tabernacle, "What is that in your hand?" And he answers that he does not know, but has come to inquire. And then the Lord tells him to put it on his face, and it's the interpreter's. He can see anything. And there's more, and to the narrative that I'll go over in the book. And also, I will argue that at this point, I'll argue from evidence in the text and from something Martin Harris said, that at this point, King Mosiah I, when he puts on the interpreters, he can actually see the Lord now through the veil. He has a theophany, like the brother of Jared on the mountain. And so that pushes temple content back to, endowment content back to 1828.
Back to the 116 with the lost pages.
Yeah. And so as they started finding this and other things too, even earlier, before 1828, where there's definite temple content, I didn't know what to do with it. I was just completely blown away. And the complexity of some of the things that I was finding, the power of them, and just the fact that they did not fit the evolutionary model that I'd had one bit, it turned me completely upside down. I mean, this was like finding the B.H. Roberts book at Deseret Book, or you know, reading Biocosm and returning to belief in God, you know.
Yeah, so you have to change your interpretive paradigm of Joseph Smith.
Right, right. And I could not believe that this, you know, boy, when he was in the 1820s, starting when he was a teenager, came up with things of this complexity and power. And I started to really believe that God was in this. And that prompted me really to pursue further what I had been working on in my mind about using different avenues of truth besides just the analytical. I started to take more seriously spiritual means of gathering, of gaining truth. And I remember thinking, if I ask myself, what is the testimony of my life's experience? Is Mormonism true? And I just thought, oh, absolutely. You know, my problems with it had not been on the level of my personal experience with the church. My issues had been intellectual issues, but as I went through this, I regained my testimony. I began to rely again on my spiritual experiences of the past, and have had then and since new ones.
Well, now during this time period, were you also working with Brian Hales during this period?
Yeah, okay, so, sorry,
and,
yeah.
And Brian Hales was doing research on the polygamy during the Nauvoo era.
Yes.
And he's asking you to go and research everything you can find about Joseph Smith and polygamy.
So this, it began shortly before I started to believe in God again. So I was an atheist when I started the research. Brian he'd previously done a book on the history of the Mormon fundamentalists, the polygamists. He wanted to tackle the subject of Joseph Smith and polygamy. Brian is very much a devout Latter-day Saint. He's an anesthesiologist.
So he needs to hire a good research assistant.
Brian's professional life wouldn't allow him to go to all the archives he would have needed to and put in the time that he needed to. What he wanted to do to make sure he was on solid ground was to look at every source that's ever been cited and anything that's ever been written on Joseph Smith and polygamy, and then see what else could be dug up. So that's what he had me do. And I already had projects in this area, and I'd known Brian from several years earlier.
And you've already decided that Joseph Smith is a philanderer and by the time you're doing this research.
I didn't believe, and I thought that I thought that sex was one of the things that motivated him.
Right. And so, in spite of this, I mean, you're gathering all of this information about Joseph Smith. You're trying to find every source that anybody has ever mentioned anything about polygamy and Joseph Smith. And subsequent to that time, you start to come to the conclusion that Joseph Smith actually was a prophet.
Right, exactly. Because of this research, because of how comprehensive it was, and by the way, when I went to most of the repositories in Utah, I had someone check something for me at the Huntington Library. I went back to Yale, to the Beinecke Library, and went through all the things I could find in the Michael Quinn collection about Joseph Smith and polygamy. This is the most, Brian's books, which are coming out anytime now, are the most comprehensive collection of sources on Joseph Smith's polygamy ever, because they make use of every source that anybody else has ever used. Plus, we found a lot of new ones, like Andrew Jensen's personal research notes that he made when he was interviewing Joseph Smith's surviving wives in the 1880s. I learned a ton about Fanny Alger relationship from that and other things. You know, so there's a lot of new stuff here. So Brian and I, there's no exaggeration in saying that Brian and I are the two people in the world right now who are the most familiar with the sources on Joseph Smith and polygamy.
Yeah, you've read it all.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So a lot of people will say, you know, the reason I left the church was because I found out that Joseph Smith was a polygamist.
Right.
Or they'll, you know, talk about this idea that Joseph Smith, you know, his theology evolved over time, and he, you know, kind of changed his story, and so that you have, you know, the Kirtland Joseph Smith, the Nauvoo Joseph Smith. You experienced all those different types of ideas.
Yes.
And you know, pushed through that to the point where you felt like Joseph Smith really was a prophet. You said that it had a lot to do with finding the value in using spiritual tools to analyze the data as opposed to the historical tools you had been using. What led you to that conclusion or to that point where you were willing to use spiritual methods of discernment?
So, you know, it's, I think, fairly common, at least for people who doubt or don't believe, to see religious experience and scholarly analysis as being at odds with one another, pointing in different directions.
Being There's mutually
a
exclusive.
Conflict, yeah. Right, between faith and reason.
Right.
You know, I did subscribe to that. That's what I thought. And I don't subscribe to that now. And the biggest reason is my own experience in this regard on the question that you're asking. So I mentioned how my paradigm of Joseph Smith as a fraud, as an opportunist, it seemed fruitful initially, but really ultimately it seemed terribly deficient. And I recognized that I needed more, that a narcissistic Joseph Smith would not explain his actions, and it wouldn't explain Mormonism. You know, Joseph Smith, the reason he's interesting is because he was a prophet. He was a religious founder, not just because he was the mayor of Nauvoo. There were lots of mayors at the time, you know, but we don't spend so much time studying these guys. They're, you know... he was married to many women. Well, there, you know, there have been a lot of polygamists in history, not that many, I suppose, in the 19th century, but still, that doesn't explain why we are so interested in the guy. Why is he so studied by historians. It's because of his religious claims. It's because of the faith that he founded and the fact that it has been such a successful and powerful faith and its impact on human lives. Well, why? You know, if the guy is a total opportunist, as I had once assumed, how do you explain why the Book of Mormon works? Why is it that I was able to, you know, use it to draw myself closer to Christ, irrespective of what I thought about its origins? You know, just reading it, taking it seriously, brought me closer to Christ. Well, this isn't what you get from a rank opportunist. You know, I shifted the questions that I ask. The importance of this principle, I don't think, can be overstated. The questions we ask largely determine the answers we get. When I was asking questions about, like, what was wrong, what were difficult things in Mormonism, how could the things that Joseph Smith did and said be interpreted as self-interested, I would find things that would seem to fit with the worldview that was assumed in the question.
Yeah, sort of confirmation bias.
Self-confirming, yeah. When I looked more closely, there was so much. The big things that make Joseph Smith, make us want to explain Joseph Smith, make us so interested in Joseph Smith, are precisely the things that can't be explained by the opportunist model that I was using. And so I was forced to ask different questions by the data themselves. And when I returned to belief, it didn't have in the least a squelching effect on my scholarship. It was exactly the opposite. It opened my eyes so much to see how Joseph Smith was doing things to achieve religious ends, spiritual ends, that I had not been able to see before that. There is no question that they're there. And when I've got a backlog of projects, and so it'll be a while before I get all these things out, but when I am able to fully publish the things that I've found in the last few years about Joseph Smith, particularly his early life, 1820s, you know, and his religious experiences, I don't think there will be that many even-handed, open-minded people who will be able to reject Joseph Smith's religious sincerity. Even if they don't believe in him as a prophet, I think they will see that there's solid reason to believe that he was sincere. And what happened when I was up at Utah State is my discoveries in early LDS history and in studying the Book of Mormon actually pressed the issue for me of, what do I do about this? This looks real. That was what got me back to taking my religious experiences seriously and relying on personal revelation. And then the resulting testimony was something that I took back with me to my scholarship, and it has enhanced my scholarship enormously. The things that I have found in the last couple years, they dwarf the things that I found before. They're so cool. And they paint so much more complete a picture of this human being, Joseph Smith. And so faith and reason and revelation and scholarship have been anything but enemies in my life since I began my return. They have been the perfect complements to one another. They've been synergistic. Each one has enhanced the other.
So let me see if I can restate what you're saying here. and try to get at what was the catalyst here. It seems that what was happening was that you were reaching out for a closer connection to Christ, and that you found that through the Book of Mormon, and it occurred to you that this product that was helping you to gain greater spiritual depth in your life came through Joseph Smith.
Yeah.
And that helped you to entertain the notion that you had been wrong in your interpretations of Joseph Smith's motives in the past, and that you were willing to consider that maybe Joseph Smith was a prophet, and that that explained Joseph Smith's actions better than simply saying he was after money, sex, and power.
Yeah. Now, the connection between my using the Book of Mormon to bring me closer to Christ and my conclusion that there was something more going on here than just this guy being opportunistic, it wasn't that linear. There was a time delay there, and there were other things. So it was the more immediate prompt for me to take personal revelation seriously again, and to take Joseph Smith being a prophet seriously again, was what I was finding about the lost 116 pages and how they anticipated Nauvoo temple theology. And I will also be arguing, again, in future papers, sometime after the book on the lost 116 pages, I'll also be arguing that there are other, what we call Nauvoo doctrines, you know, Nauvoo Mormonism, that's anticipated in things that are going on with Joseph Smith in the 1820s. There is growth, there is evolution in Joseph Smith, but it's nowhere near as radical as people have thought. He doesn't begin as a Protestant boy who ends up as this radical Nauvoo Mormon prophet. He begins as a very unusual Christian. He's already on the track that leads to temple, the endowment, temple theology, and other distinctive aspects of Mormon theology from day one.
Right. I mean, some people have seen him as a prophet who gave us the Book of Mormon and then fell and just, you know, decided to start engaging in polygamy and Freemasonry,
right,
and, you know, develops this whole other, you know, practice after he's a fallen prophet.
Right.
But you discovered that he was a prophet from the beginning, and he may have learned line by line and, you know, discovered, you know, many great and you know, glorious things pertaining to the kingdom of God, but that it was all part of the same progression, and that there wasn't this gulf dividing the prophet from the, you know, philanderer and the, you know, the megalomaniac of Nauvoo. It was Joseph Smith the prophet from the beginning.
Right. There was a greater measure of consistency throughout from beginning to end than what they would see. Joseph Smith had powerful spiritual experiences early on, and I think in some ways he spends the rest of his life unfolding things that he learned at the beginning.
And trying to figure them out.
Yes.
You know, how do I explain this?
Yes, and to put them into practice and teach others.
And strangely, you know, the man who gave us the Book of Mormon in many ways doesn't seem to appreciate what's in the Book of Mormon. He spends most of his time preaching from the Bible, and he doesn't talk a lot about what's actually in the Book of Mormon, and seems completely oblivious to so many of the things that we appreciate today about the Book of Mormon, and these things that that you're finding. These are new and unique finds that nobody has recognized before, and so I think it's so interesting. You know, we try so hard to find, you know, the reason somebody left or the reason somebody came back, and it sounds like what you're talking about is how there's a multifaceted explanation, and one of the really interesting things too is that it's not that, you know, God hit you over the head with a spiritual hammer, and it's not that he argued you back into the church, but that there were there was this combination
right.
of spiritual experiences, you know, spiritual tuggings back toward Christ, back toward the Book of Mormon, and at the same time you're doing research that helps you to see that Joseph Smith did some really amazing things that can't be explained outside of the context of his prophetic calling.
Right. So the two streams came together.
And so yeah. it is faith and reason.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Fantastic. So when you then started to feel like, wow, Joseph Smith really was a prophet, and you know, this church was true all along. What did you decide? I mean, what were you thinking that you were going to do at that point?
So I knew it was something like May 3rd, 2010. It was one of the very last days of the semester. And I know that because I'd been working on a paper that had some of this Lost Pages stuff in it at that time. And that was really prompting my thoughts, you know, making me... My research was coming together with my personal reflections about how I needed to seek, needed to rely on spiritual means of gaining spiritual truth. I remember realizing that I was going back to the church. I remember realizing that I had been wrong. I remember I was really overwhelmed It was also jubilant, you know. It was wonderful.
This is in Logan.
This was up in Logan. Yeah, I think I was sitting in the library cafe there, just trying to figure all this out. Just totally dumbfounded, you know, what I'd found, and I knew that I needed to initiate the process of going back to the church. So I went online to figure out how. After all, that's how I'd left, right? I'd gone and found the instructions. Well, online, if you want to leave the church, you've got all different websites to tell you how to do it, who to call, form letters, everything. Even recently, there was a mass resignation event in Salt Lake, right? Or so-called, and a group thing, and you know, they dropped off their letters, and then they hiked up Ensign Peak, ironically, so you may even have someone to like literally hold your hand through the process if you want to leave, right? If you want to come back, like, it's hard to find the information. The people are there; they're very accepting. You know, the church leaders of someone who wants to come back. But I think it's unfortunate that we haven't given people a better picture of what it's like to come back to the church.
And what to expect.
What to expect.
Yeah, because
daunting.
Well, I'm sure it occurred to you that you could go to a bishop and ask. But I guess what you're saying is you didn't know what to expect.
I didn't know what to expect, and I don't like to go into things completely blind, you know. Especially not something really big like this. And so I looked online. I really could find almost nothing. So I went and I found the stake president down here in Utah Valley, whom I had met with.
Who said, you're coming back.
Right. Whom I had humored by saying it was possible I would come back, right? He was no longer the stake president, but I found him, showed up on his doorstep and asked if he remembered me. He did. And I asked if he remembered, you know, what he told me. He did. And, I told him he was right. He wasn't too surprised. He was very pleased though. And, I got a little glimpse from him of what it might be like. You know, I just said some fairly general things, but that was enough. It was enough for me to take the step. I went over the summer. I was living in Murray, doing some work there in between, you know, school years, And I went, set up an appointment with the local bishop there, whom I'd never met, showed up at his office, and, you know, just kind of told the basics of the story, you know, that I had left, and a little bit about that, and how I'd been gone out of the church for almost 5 years, and how I had realized that I had been wrong and I wanted to come back. And I was very emotional about it. And I hadn't really been in that situation before where, you know, it was a real confession type situation. And I'd never had anything really big to confess before, you know, when I'd been involved in the church. And so I didn't know what to expect, and he just sat and listened. He was just very warm and very accepting, and he just wanted to get me back into the church, you know? And he told me, though, that I was probably going to have to account for things that were in my letter, my exit letter. And that worried me, because remember, I'd written that letter with the intention of making church leaders think that it was impossible to keep me in the church.
Yeah, you felt like you burned your bridges.
Right.
And you got to go back over the chasm.
And so I dug up a copy of the letter, and I read it, and I cried. I remember saying to myself, they're never going to let me back into the church. Bishop had a copy of the letter sent to him from the confidential records, I think it is, in the membership department. And, you know, he was very reassuring to me, though. I called him very upset after I'd read my letter, and he told me I didn't need to worry, and he said if the church couldn't forgive, it wouldn't be Christ's church. And, you know, it really was not, I had no idea how long to expect the process to be, and it varies from what I understand quite a bit. It really wasn't that long. I mean, I'd been afraid that it would be like a year or more. It wasn't. I only had to meet with the bishop, but he, no one else. He wanted me to take the bishop in a case like this has a lot of discretion, I guess, in what the person needs to do in order to come back to the church. It's not treated like a case of church discipline, which I think is what I had been afraid of. I'd been afraid that there would be something punitive.
In other words, when somebody resigns to come back, they're not, you know, getting a disciplinary council back.
No, they don't have to convene a disciplinary council. Hmm. Certainly they didn't need to in this case, you know. And that's my understanding, that they don't need to. But he wanted me to take the missionary discussions. After all the research that I've done on LDS scriptures and on Joseph Smith and other things in church history, the idea seemed really bizarre to me, especially since I'd been a missionary, you know. And I remember balking at the idea at first, but, you know, agreeing to it, of course, because I couldn't get back into the church fast enough.
Why do you think he asked you to do that?
You know, I'm not sure why he asked it, but I do know why I ended up feeling like it was actually a very good idea. At first, it just sounded wild to me, you know.
And maybe a little pointless.
Yeah.
And they're not going to teach me anything I don't know.
Right, right. That's how I felt.
So what did it do for you?
Well, but then before the discussion started, I realized, I remember the discussions, you know, I remember that you commit people to live certain principles that they're going to be living as members of the church. And I thought, you know, this will actually be a great chance to recommit myself to the things that I'll be living. And so I approached it in that spirit. And also, I must admit, I thought it would just be the most fascinating little bit of ethnographic research, right? To see how is it, what is it like to be an investigator, you know?
Yeah, because did these missionaries, did these missionaries know your history?
They didn't. The bishop didn't want them to know that I used to be a member of the church. They told them something. They told them, like, not to commit me to baptism or something, but they wouldn't explain to them why.
Because you would have agreed on the first discussion, and you know, then you wouldn't have been able to go through all the commitments of all the other discussions, I guess.
Yeah, well, and the bishop didn't want them to give the discussions any differently than they would have to a non-member.
Right.
He didn't want them to skip anything, leave anything out, and that's why he didn't want them to know. And so we went through all the discussions, and each time there was a member of the bishopric was there for that discussion. The first discussion that they gave, right before it, I had been online on one of the online message boards, like just like gabbing on Mormonism, like the Mormon Dialogue or something, you know, gabbing about things, arguing. And, at the end of the discussion, I sat there just pondering for a while, and then I went on to do something else, and I thought, oh, well, I'll go back to what was I doing before, and I thought, oh, I'll go back on the message board. And I found that I just really didn't want to, because I felt like I was on such an elevated plane that to go into all that nasty arguing and everything would just be, I'd be dropping from such a high point, you know. And I felt something that I remember one of the investigators in my mission saying down in Houston. He told us one time that each time we would come, there would be a light that was there with us, and it would linger with him for the rest of the day until he went to bed. And then the next morning when he'd wake up, it was gone. That's what I was feeling. I felt this light, and I felt elevated, you know, and the discussions really, in spite of, you know, how fundamental the things that are taught in them are, every discussion I gain new insights on things that I've learned about since I was a kid, you know, and every discussion I felt the Spirit. And so it was a wonderful experience. I was still afraid of dealing with that letter that I'd written. But the bishop, and this was probably inspiration, I don't know. He asked me, one reason why I didn't want to deal with that letter was not only because I'd written it strongly, but also because I'm a writer. It's the main thing I've done professionally. I'm good at it. And I don't feel like I am as good a speaker as I am a writer. But he wanted me to, I thought I was going to have to account, just talk through the letter. And so my sort of, my speaking self would be competing with my writing self. And instead, he asked me to write a letter dealing with the things that I'd written in my earlier letter and formally requesting readmission to the church. I did. I wrote the letter, and the new letter was so much better than the original letter. It accounted for everything that had been in that letter, and then so much more, you know. He asked me to meet with him and read it out loud to him, and I did. And as soon as I was done, he formally invited me to be rebaptized into the church. I was ecstatic. That was on a Thursday, and I was baptized the following Sunday.
So had you been attending that ward during this time?
Yeah, I'd been attending the local ward there. And there are things sometimes about, you know, there's a difference, of course, between the gospel and Mormon culture. And there's things sometimes about Mormon culture that have bugged me. They don't bug me as much now as they used to, but things where I feel like I'm different maybe from some of the prevailing things in the culture. One unfortunate and completely unnecessary thing that we sometimes have in LDS culture is a sort of a strain of anti-intellectualism where, like, if you were talking to a Jewish family and you told them that your daughter was going to marry a guy who was a real intellectual, they would say, oh, that's wonderful. You know, if you're talking to a Mormon family, you know, and you tell them your daughter's marrying a guy who's a real intellectual, they might think that's something to be concerned about. You know, intellectual is not necessarily a good word for Mormons, you know. Yet we believe that the glory of God is intelligence, and we're saved no faster than we gain knowledge. You know, so there's really no reason for us to be, you know, anti-intellectual, but sometimes you have some of that. And so there are things like that in Mormon culture that I haven't been completely fond of. And I went back to church, and I hadn't gone much to church in a long time, and I kind of worried, even though I had regained my testimony, I knew that the church was true, I knew that God wanted me to be back in the church, I was still kind of worried about what it would be like day by day, week by week, going to church. You know, when I'd left the church, I'd felt bugged by a lot of things at church, and bored. And when I came back, that's not how I felt. To my great surprise, I found that I gained a lot from going to church, and the people seemed, that in that ward and ever since, the wards I've been in since, the people, they seemed really great. They seemed very intelligent in how they approached gospel things. You know, not always. There were some comments, of course, that I don't agree with, but I thought, since when have there been so many intelligent, thoughtful people in the church, you know? And of course, I knew that it wasn't the church that had changed. It was my perspective.
Yeah, you know, and it seems like that when, you know, the Spirit works on us, that we're so much more accepting of other people and willing to forgive. And, you know, when somebody says some strange thing in church, you're not as offended. You think, well, that's a little bit off, but that's okay because I love that person.
Right. We're all part of the same community. We're all part of the body of Christ.
Right. And so did you continue your researching of these issues with Joseph Smith during this period?
Yeah. My research has just, as I mentioned earlier, just blossomed since then. You know, the questions that I ask, it's a more complete set of questions, you know, not that simplistic, just what was in it for him question. And I feel like I understand the man, Joseph Smith, so much better in all of his complexities and humanness. And I feel like I understand not only his weaknesses, and he had very real weaknesses, you know, but I understand not only those, but I understand some of the fantastic, enormous character strengths that he had as well.
Well, and it seems that you had established yourself as a Joseph Smith scholar by this point, and that you were invited to participate in the Joseph Smith Papers Project.
Yes.
And so how did that come about?
So this was 5 months after my rebaptism. I was contacted by someone at the Joseph Smith Papers asking if I would like to come and do a several-month internship working on, there are different series in the Joseph Smith Papers, working on what they call the Document Series, which is actually the main series. Working on Volume 1 of the Document Series, which covers 1825 to 1831. In other words, like the time period that I've worked on the most, the early stuff, you know, the stuff that I get most excited about. And I was thrilled. I thought, you know, like, don't they know that I was outside the church for 5 years, and I've only been back for 5 months.
Who approached you with this invitation?
So I was contacted by Mark Ashurst McGee, my friend. He had contacted me on behalf of Ron Esplin, who was the
one of the
manager.
Editors. Yeah. Okay.
They did in fact know, and I knew that they knew, partly because there was at least one person from the Joseph Smith papers who was at my rebaptism. So they certainly knew that I had been outside the church. It was fantastic there. It was amazing. After I started at the Joseph Smith papers, shortly afterward, I had a chance to meet with Elder Jensen. It was somewhat coincidental because it was a meeting I had set up before I'd even been invited to the Joseph Smith papers. I was meeting with him about a project of mine and how he would suggest that I approach some things in it. And at the end of that meeting, he said to me, I want you to know that we know all about your little detour that you took in your faith, and it doesn't matter. And he added a little more, saying something about how, they were just really glad to have me back in the church and glad to have me there to contribute. Having communicated with Elder Jensen since then about this, because I got his permission to quote him, he said he thought it would be good if I made clear that he wasn't saying that it is a matter of no consequence if someone leaves the church. It's a matter of huge consequence, but it was just a completely accepting attitude toward me. And, my having been outside the church was not at all held against me then or since. I've been in the church 2 years and a few months, and I've never had anyone who has been less than accepting of me. This is one of the things that I feared coming back into the church, was that there would be some sort of, black stain on me,
like a scarlet letter.
A for apostate or something, right? And it didn't happen. Not at all. I meant to mention this earlier when I talked about studying Joseph Smith and polygamy in connection with having worked at the church historical department. You asked earlier if I'd been denied access to documents that to see. When I was doing all this research on Joseph Smith's polygamy, I did request access to some restricted documents. Now, documents, I think there's this common perception, particularly among people who maybe doubt or kind of on the fringes, that the church has all these damaging materials that they're restricting because they're damaging.
Yeah, they're only showing the scholars the good stuff.
Right, because they know there's all this bad stuff in them.
Yeah.
Documents, almost always, documents of the church archives that are restricted, which is a small subset of all the documents that they had, are restricted because they fit in one or another restricted category. So, for instance, there's the category of sacred. So temple, things about the endowment, and patriarchal blessings are considered sacred. The patriarchal blessing was for the person it was given to. It wasn't for the whole world to read. And of course, temple stuff is to be kept in the temple. And so anything that has temple content, and most things that have patriarchal blessings, are restricted access. Another category is private. So records of disciplinary councils are considered private because, as we believe, these people continue to exist. If somebody's dead, that doesn't mean that they no longer exist. They are still a person, and they still, therefore, in the way that the church looks at it, they still have some right to privacy. And so, if the person did things in their life that were wrong, We really don't need to shout those from the housetops. You know, maybe the person later repented and was readmitted to the church, or maybe, you know, maybe they've since come back and re-embrace the gospel fully in the spirit world, you know. So things like that are restricted access. General authority collections generally are given, not all, but most are given restricted access. There are really just a few categories of restricted access documents. Restricted access doesn't mean that nobody gets to look at them. It means that people have to request permission, and then the historical department, people in the historical department, need to make a judgment about why is this person wanting to look at this? What are they going to do with it? So, for instance, the documents that I wanted to look at that were restricted, it was almost all of them, it was for temple content that was also in the document, along with Joseph Smith polygamy stuff. I was given permission to look at every one of the documents that I requested permission to look at.
This is while you were a non-member.
I was not a member. That didn't matter. They weren't asking for a temple recommend or anything. They were asking, what did I want to do with this document? When I reassured them, I would reassure them, no, I don't want to see anything. I don't want to use anything there about the temple. I only want to see the things about Joseph Smith's polygamy. Then they let me look at the documents. And that's exactly the opposite of what people would think, because people think that things are restricted. People think that they would restrict things like stuff that talks about Joseph Smith's polygamy. That's exactly wrong. When I would tell them, I only want to look at the things on Joseph Smith's polygamy, that reassured them, and that was what enabled me to look at the documents.
Interesting.
So the restrictions, they don't work anything like what a lot of people are assuming. And that's been my experience. And then I got the opportunity to work in the historical department from the inside. There is an employee version of the catalog that shows more information, you know, and so on. I got to learn more about sort of how the whole process works. And I can tell you, it doesn't work the way that a lot of people are assuming. The church leaders are not finding out that some document has damaging things in it and restricting it. Most things that would have, most of the documents there that might raise difficult questions are open for everybody to look at. They're only not open if they fit one of these categories.
So as you've continued your research into the history of the early church, the history of Joseph Smith, how do you feel now about Joseph Smith?
Joseph Smith, I have absolutely no doubt, so I'll get to different aspects of how I view Joseph Smith, but one is just based on my research, what I feel about him and know about him from being a Joseph Smith scholar. Joseph Smith, I have absolutely no doubt, on historical grounds alone, he was a spiritual giant. He had tremendous insight. He had enormous character strengths. He had true human weaknesses too. And I think we don't want to skip over that fact, you know. But he had some of his character strengths were so enormous that I'm astonished that anyone has had character strengths that great. It's no mystery to me, you know, for a long time, you know, back when I was reading the Book of Mormon as a non-believer to get closer to Christ because of its content, you know, I wondered, how could somebody like this, how could somebody like Joseph Smith have been the conduit for this book? How could he have written this book, you know? Now, given what I know about Joseph Smith, it is absolutely no mystery to me at all why God would have chosen someone like Joseph Smith to do his work. God chooses to do his work, people who are capable of doing the work that he wants done. And Joseph Smith had abilities as a person and character strengths that enabled him to understand the mind of God and draw close to God enough to understand his mind and do the work of bringing about the restoration that almost nobody else has ever had. And that's why he was chosen. So Joseph Smith is someone with whom I have, you know, kind of had a rocky relationship over time with, right? I started out really, he was a hero to me when I was growing up, you know, but it was a very sort of simplistic version of Joseph Smith that I lionized. Then I became progressively more disenchanted with him until he was almost like a villain, you know, it completely switched roles for me. And then I started to maybe be able to accept him more as a human being while still, you know, thinking that he was an opportunist. But ultimately, now Joseph Smith is someone for whom I am profoundly grateful. Someone who, you know, I don't admire his human weaknesses. You know, weaknesses aren't the things that we admire about people. But his profound strengths and the work that he did leave me just astounded.
Well, and as you've continued to research and to study and you're delving into the history of the church, like you said, there are a lot of members of the church that would feel like you're on dangerous territory. You know what? You know, you may find something there that's upsetting and that may shake your faith again. What have you done to maintain your faith since coming back into the church?
You know, most of the things that although I did go through a period where the things that I was seeing in church history, certainly the way that I was perceiving them, were troubling to me. Overwhelmingly, the last few years, the things that I have found are faith-affirming. So for me, delving into Mormon history with the sort of broad, broadened perspective that I have, actually, it's something that's helpful to me in my faith. It's not something that harms my faith. Also, in my personal spiritual life, there are times when I feel my testimony more strongly than others, you know, and it depends, to some extent, it depends on what I'm doing. I find that when I go to the temple, it is probably the biggest thing that sort of resets my perspective and gives me the big picture. And it puts a lot of smaller things in my life and things in church history into this huge eternal perspective. Reading the Book of Mormon, not just reading it, but I found that what seems to help me the most to have my faith be strong and my testimony and to feel close to God is if I approach scripture reading, not really as scripture reading, but if I approach it more as an opportunity to invite the Spirit into my life by reading the scriptures, you know, to seek the presence of the Spirit and to seek personal inspiration through reading the scriptures.
And what about with other members of the church, you know, when you encounter people that maybe offend you at church or things that, you know, about our practices or culture that, you know, sometimes can, you know, be upsetting or disconcerting, things that church leaders may do or, you know, things that you wonder, you know, why do we do it that way? How have you dealt with those types of issues?
So when I came back to the church, I came back to it with a very different attitude from the one with which I had left the church. One huge difference is the degree to which I focus on the negative or the positive. When someone becomes disillusioned with anything, when we become disillusioned with anything, we tend to see the negative. The negative becomes the predominant thing for us. That's obviously where I was when I left. When I came back, I made a very conscious decision that I wasn't going to do that, that I was going to focus on the positives. I didn't rejoin the church because there's some person in Sunday school who makes ridiculous comments. I didn't rejoin the church because, you know, some general authority might sometimes say something that would be troubling to me or something like that. I rejoined the church because of the positive, beautiful truths in it. And so those are the things that I'm going to focus on. I don't want I'm going to experience aspects of LDS culture that won't be what I would prefer. I'm going to experience the imperfections of other church members. We're not already in Zion or the Celestial Kingdom here. We're in the world that we're in, and we've got all our weaknesses. And, you know, when you're part of a community, your weaknesses become common property. You know, that's the way it is. So do your strengths. Because I don't want to make other people's weaknesses or unattractive aspects of Mormon culture or something that may bother me from church history, because I don't want to make that a larger part of my life experience, I'm not going to put my focus on it. I'm going to put my focus on the things that I want to experience more of, and that I want to build more of into my life. And I think in some ways we feed things through the attention that we give to them. It's like we nourish them with the attention that we give to them. If I don't want to nourish certain negative traits in other people or, you know, things, anything unpleasant or bad that I see in LDS culture or in the church, then it really shouldn't be the focus of my attention. And so I came back to the church determined that to shift a biblical parable a little. I came back to the church determined that I would nourish the wheat until it chokes the tares. You know, that there's wheat and there are tares. The wheat in the church, it is so vastly greater than the tares. You know, the restoration is a powerful and beautiful thing. There's so much in it to appreciate and so much in it to enjoy and to grow from. And it would just be a shame, you know, to let the much smaller negative things crowd that out.
You know, that maybe leads into this next question, but one of the things I think people may wonder is, why is it that some people will study early history of the church, read about Joseph Smith, and decide the church isn't true, and other people can go their whole lives as church historians, you know, studying this stuff, and not leave the church? What is it you think that makes the difference?
I think that probably varies a lot case by case. You know, as I look at my own spiritual journey, it doesn't seem to me like a simple thing, you know, that could be put into just a particular box or other. I do think there probably are some frequent factors that frequently help shape how people deal with trouble, problem areas. One of those would be the assumptions that people bring to bear on questions surrounding the church. And I've got there are several assumptions that I would zero in on. One assumption is that these are what I would call unhelpful assumptions. One is that if there's any evidence for something, then it's true, or if there's any evidence against something, then it's false.
Jumping to conclusions.
Yeah, if that were the case, how simple religion and politics and science would be, right? If there was never conflicting evidence on things. There's almost always conflicting evidence on things, and that's what makes it complex and difficult for people to figure out right answers. I mean, you look at the political world right now, sometimes there's a consensus largely on certain issues, among scientists. You take some issues like certain environmental issues like global warming, there is a small subset of scientists who disagree. They see some evidence against it. They're not completely manufacturing it. There's evidence for and there's evidence against. So the question is, where is there the most evidence? Where's the preponderance of evidence? So if someone finds, a problem, if they find evidence that something that they would look at and say, well, this is evidence that, the Book of Mormon is a 19th century document. That doesn't mean that there isn't evidence that the Book of Mormon is an ancient document. It's not helpful to oversimplify and think that if there's evidence on one side of something, then that settles the question. Life is more complex than that.
Okay. Well, I guess also assuming that one mode of knowledge is sufficient, so that, when you talk about gathering evidence, we gather, evidence from historical documents, and we have a little bit here, a little bit there. So maybe, we see one journal entry or something that confirms or seems to confirm a view that Joseph Smith, is in it for money, sex, or power, and we run with that. Or maybe we find something on the other side, and we decide we need to start looking for all the documents and see which pile ends up the highest, and we ignore other types of knowledge, like you said, spiritual knowledge, or knowledge from witnesses, which is perhaps a different type of knowledge, or knowledge from just the experience that, what are the fruits of living in this church and following the path that Joseph Smith set out for us.
Right.
What other kinds of assumptions do you think people make that can lead them to conclusions that the church is not true?
Another one, and I know here that I'm disagreeing with a lot of people, but the assumption that the gospel is and should be simple. There are aspects of the gospel that are simple, and that are simple enough for, our little children to understand, so we can teach them certain basics about being Christ-like and about, Christ as our Savior and so on. And that may be enough for them at their age and level of maturity for them to live. But if the gospel were simple, then it would be unlike every other domain of knowledge, domain of understanding that we know. As you learn more about mathematics, it doesn't get simpler. It gets more complex. As we learn more about how our universe works, we're confronted with more and more particles and more forces. It's not getting simpler. It's getting more complex. As we learn more about genetics and living organisms, our understanding is getting more complex. And so I don't see why we should expect that in the domain of religion, somehow it's different and everything, it's simple at the level we're at now, and it continues all the way through the spectrum of progression, it remains simple. Another reason why I would challenge that assumption is that if the gospel were simple, how could we keep learning in it throughout our lives? If it were really simple, we'd all have it down by now. We'd know everything that there is to know. We wouldn't be learning new doctrine. I wouldn't learn something new every time I go to the temple or every time I open my scriptures. I think the problem with the assumption that the gospel is and should be simple is not just that it's not correct, it's also that people are expecting everything to be simple. And so if they learn anything that brings greater complexity to their view, if they need to change their view of prophets or their view of how revelation works, that, no, it's not as simple as I thought. You know, it's not like God just drops this huge weight of revelation onto a prophet who's nearly superhuman. If that's not really how it works, then this must not be true, because I thought this gospel thing was supposed to be really simple. You know, I don't think it's simple, and I don't think we're doing ourselves a favor when we set up the expectation that it needs to be simple.
Well, it sounds like to some degree what you're talking about is the level to which we have tolerance for ambiguity. And so if we find something that is maybe paradoxical or maybe contradicts a previously held view, what we may tend to do is jump to a simple conclusion to help explain that and relieve any kind of cognitive dissonance we may be experiencing, rather than stepping back and saying, well, maybe this is more complicated than I thought. Maybe I need to do more thinking about this because there's this apparent contradiction. Allowing ourselves to experience some discomfort with some of these apparent contradictions or paradoxes for a while, and with faith that we will come through to a greater level of knowledge as we persist.
Right. I think, yes. And I think as we come through to a greater level of knowledge, a greater level of knowledge is actually a more complex level of knowledge, because it's not just telling us something extremely simple. It's taking different, like, to resolve a paradox, you have to have something that will account for the seemingly opposing things and integrate them together somehow. And when you integrate different things, you're dealing with a more complex understanding. And maybe the way that I'm using the word complex is different than how you would use it, but I think we're agreeing.
You know, what you're saying there reminds me of a quote that I heard from Niels Bohr, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist. When they talk about quantum mechanics and quantum physics, and there's so many kind of strange things that come out of quantum physics. He said, how wonderful it is that we've met with a paradox. Now we have hope of making progress. Mm. And I think that so much of the gospel is like that. I think that God must love paradoxes, I mean, Jesus, in so many of his sermons, he gives us these paradoxes. He who is last shall be first, and first shall be last. Or he who seeks to save his life shall lose it. Or some of the the modern day commandments we have, you're supposed to get out of debt, but we want you to pay a generous fast offering, and so there's this tension that's created, what do I do? Do I just not pay a fast offering while I'm trying to get out of debt, or how many people would be paying fast offerings of this in this church if we all waited to get out of debt before we started paying fast offerings? So I think what that does is that, that kind of tension that creates is it causes us, so some people, throw up their arms and say, this is too hard, I can't do this. Other people, it causes them to turn toward God and to seek higher knowledge, to seek spiritual understanding and comfort. And I kind of think that that's the point, is that we are to turn toward God for our direction, rather than just trying to just figure it out all ourselves. So, you know, so those things can lead to disaffection from the church when we don't have a tolerance for ambiguity or an appreciation for things that we don't know. We think maybe we've got it all figured out, and, you know, there's something we don't understand, and we think, well, it must not be true then. Rather than pushing forward into areas that were uncomfortable or unfamiliar to us.
Thank you for listening to the Mormon Faircast. If there is an issue that you've been wondering about, you can often find the latest answers at the Fair Wiki, found at fairmormon.org. If you can't find your answer there, feel free to pose your question to the Fair Apologists by visiting the Fair contact page. Questions or comments about this episode can be sent to podcast@fairlds.org or join the conversation at fairblog.org. Tell your friends about us and help increase the popularity of this podcast by subscribing in iTunes and by writing a review. Music for this episode was provided courtesy of Paul Cardall. The opinions expressed in this podcast are not necessarily the views of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints or of FAIR.